Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Elson, and we're set as usual with our Sunday morning show. And we're going to talk baseball today with one of the best informed managers in the game and an old friend of mine. I guess Earl Weaver and I have had interviews maybe 25 or 30 times over the years, and he's recognized as one of the outstanding managers in the big leagues. And he's an old friend, and we're delighted that he's with us. Remember, the White Sox have an afternoon game today with Baltimore, and this is the final game of the series. And also, the Cubs are at Atlanta for the final game of their series, and then everything changes around. So if you have a chance today, get out and see the game between the White Sox and Baltimore. There are teams that both have been playing well, and it should be a very interesting ball game, and it's a very nice day for it. Our guest, Earl Weaver, the manager of Baltimore, and we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Earl Weaver, the manager of the Baltimore Club. Last year, Earl, it looked like you were doing it with mirrors. You were right in there with the Yankees and the Red Sox practically for all year, and I think that every baseball fan in the country, except those in Boston and New York, we're pulling for you to really come up with a miracle.
Well, we had a lot of good talent. We had good young talent in our farm system. The expansion draft was last year, and also we lost a few players through the free agent route. But we had people that we were trying to get onto our roster and into the regular lineup, people such as Richie Dower, Billy Smith, young pitchers, Dennis Martinez and Scott McGregor, and wound up with 8 rookies on the ball club. But they were capable of participating in the American League, and not only capable of participating, but doing a good job. And we put our confidence in the younger fellows, and they certainly came through for us.
Earl Weaver, your life has really been dedicated to baseball. What was the alternative, if there was one? Everyone knew that baseball couldn't live forever with the reserve clause. What happened after the reserve clause was knocked out of the box by a judge in Kansas City, what other alternatives were there?
Well, there really were none, because the owners agreed that this was the only system that could be put into effect at this particular time. And it was agreed on by the Players Association and the owners, and a workable one. And without the agreement, the new basic agreement, there just wouldn't have been any baseball the year before. I think that the free agent system, the way it's put into effect now, where a ball club such as ours can hold on to our ball players for 6 years, was probably the best solution that could come up, and it was the best for the ball players and a workable one for the owners. The owners are still showing profits, and in the cities where the ball clubs put a representable team on the field, and the farm system eventually will be have to be the place where the new talent comes from, and the people that go out and sign the good ball players and bring them through the systems are the people that are still going to exist and have good ball clubs.
Well, you and I knew when the minor leagues were really alive, and they had all these different leagues, the Southern Association, the American Association, the Pacific Coast League, the Eastern League, all that's gone. When you refer to a farm system, what are you referring to?
Well, we have 5 ball clubs that we supply players to, and we haven't cut the budget as far as our farm system is concerned, because we're the people that believe that if you're going to have good ball players in the major leagues, you have to go to the high schools and the colleges, find the best ones, sign them, and then instruct them well the 2 or 3 or 4 years that it's required for them to learn the trade and to get to the big leagues. You know, the Reggie Jacksons, who have signed the big contracts this year, 6 years from now are going to be at that age where they're not going to demand that salary. And 6 years from now, the free agents are going to have to come from someplace. And I think that in our situation, where we had 8 rookies last year, the Eddie Murrays, Dennis Martinez's, and people like that will be the big money ball players of the future. Now, that doesn't mean all of them will defect and go to other ball clubs. because, well, certainly in our situation, we've had real good ball players on the Baltimore Orioles. We'll take Jim Palmer and a Kenny Singleton in particular, who, in place of going out and buying other ball players, we chose to pay these people for the job that they did for us. And they have million-dollar contracts, although it hasn't been publicized because of the fact that they have stayed with the ball club that they had their success with. But our payroll is up there with most of the clubs in the American League, and I think you do a good job if you retain the fellas who have done a job for you and don't let your ball club get full of holes. There'll have to be somebody if you're going to let we'll say an Eddie Murray 6 years from now walk away. You'll have to have somebody in your farm system who is ready at that particular time to come up and replace them. And if you keep doing that type of job, then you're never going to be out without the talent that you need to compete.
Earl Weaver, as you look back on the beginning of your career, let's say in your playing days, did you ever think that you'd live to see a ball player making $2 or $3 million for 5 or 6 years?
Well, yes, I did, because we can go back to probably the greatest drawing card of all times, Babe Ruth, who made the $80,000 playing for the New York Yankees when other people in the American League were probably being paid at the rate of $1,500 or $2,000 per year. And in comparison, his salary is so much higher for those days when you paid no taxes, and we'll say a bushel of potatoes might cost you 35 cents at that time. His salary was so out of proportion in that day, and knowing that the owners could pay it at that particular time would make you think that salaries in baseball were far below what the owners really could afford to pay, and you just knew that it had to escalate, because in with Marvin Miller and the Players Association and the negotiations that went on, Marvin always said and still says that if you can raise the highest player salary in the American League, then that will bring up the norm, and that's what it's done. It's raised the average pay of the Major League ball player considerably in the last 3 or 4 years.
Where were you in the height of Babe Ruth's playing days?
Well, in the height of Babe Ruth's playing days, really, I wasn't even born. I was born in 1930, and Ruth had some great years in the early 30s, and I did get out to the ballpark when he was finishing up and did get a chance to see him play baseball. However, it wasn't his great years with the New York Yankees in the 20s.
Yeah, he was fantastic. Speaking of the 30s, I broadcast the first All-Star game when Babe Ruth hit a home run with Gehringer on board to win that ball game, and he was really and truly something.
Well, there was no doubt he probably had to be the greatest athlete of his time, and capable of doing things that other people couldn't do at that time. And probably if he played today, he could still do things that, you know, yeah, in his prime that only, we'll say, a Reggie Jackson could do or has done. But I don't think you could put anybody in Ruth's category today because of the things he accomplished on the mound, 29 scoreless innings before he even became an everyday ball player in the outfield, and then the number of home runs he hit and the big home runs he hit. I think that he'd have to be put in a class by himself. Later on, Ted Williams came along, and probably the greatest hitter that I've ever seen play day in and day out is Ted Williams, as far as swinging the bat. And DiMaggio, who accomplished the things that he did in New York, are in a class by himself. But we do have players today that are capable of doing everything, you know, the way it should be done.
Earl Weaver, you just mentioned two of my favorite people, not only great ball players, Williams and DiMaggio. Hypothetically, in a ball game where you're tied in the ninth inning, say 2-2, and there's a man on second base and two out, which one of those two guys would you rather not have come up to the plate?
You'd have to walk them both if they were hitting back-to-back, if that was the winning run on second base, because you knew that they were going to get him in. The one thing that Williams was criticized for, we'll say in a situation like that, is he would not swing at a bad pitch. But that is what made him such a great hitter, and that was his success. Williams would have never accomplished the things that he accomplished in baseball had he started swinging at the bad pitches. In place of hitting 400, he's going to make outs on bad pitches trying to get that extra run in, and the average certainly would have suffered. DiMaggio was a good ball hitter. He was like a machine, but he also got his base on balls. Probably the one thing about that, if you were pitching against Boston, you could afford to walk Williams and pitch around Williams because they didn't have quite the number of good ball players that the Yankees had at that time. And if you got around DiMaggio, you were just going to face a Keller or Tommy Hendricks or somebody else, so you might as well lose it right there with him.
Well, he was really something. He was really a great all-around ball player. You know, he was a, I can remember when he started in the big leagues, he was the world's greatest introvert. And as you know, he married the world's greatest extrovert, Marilyn Monroe. And later on in the late years of his life, he was terrific on the radio.
Oh, yes, he was. But you watch a lot of young ball players come through the minor leagues and their first year in the major leagues, and they're apprehensive about what they're going to say. They don't want to get themselves in trouble. They know that a lot of things that are said can be taken out of context, that they can be misquoted. The big thing is trying to put your thoughts into words where even if you're not taken out of context or not misquoted, really the words out of a young person sometimes come out a lot differently than he means them to sound. And I think that most all avoid the publicity and the limelight the first two or three years that they're in the big leagues. But once you're there and you get a feeling of belonging and you feel more free to say the things that you want to say, and it's wonderful to watch a person like that mature and go through the stages of growing up and becoming the type of person that really everybody should strive to be.
Earl Weaver, are great hitters born or are they developed? And why is it that you see it? I saw it all during the 38 years that I was doing big league ball games. Why is it a lot of ball players hit 228, 230, 234, and they stay right at that level for their entire baseball career? Can't they be helped?
Well, there's a number of things that are involved. Certainly work is going to help to a certain amount, but some people are born with fear of the baseball and just can't make themselves go into that outside pitch as well as some other people. The second thing I think that's involved is physical strength. In our case, we'll take a Mark Belanger, who we work with constantly. He's been a 230 hitter lifetime, or 235 in the major leagues, and certainly has helped the ball club with that average. But you're always striving for him to have that year where he hit 270 or 280, which he has on occasions in the major leagues. Well, there's physical strength there involved, where Mark, Reggie was out there watching us work with him one time, and when he was playing with us, Reggie Jackson, and he wanted to give Mark a few tips about getting a bat out and stroking the ball easy, and we let Reggie go in there. Well, when Reggie gripped the bat, he had muscles that bulged from his elbows almost up to his chin, and he'd take the same swing as Mark Belanger. He'd show Mark how to take a swing, and the ball jumped off the bat, and it ricocheted off the right center field wall. Then Mark would take the same swing, hit the ball just as hard, but it would be one of those balls that would get up in between the left fielder and center fielder, where there would be time for the outfielder to run under it. So physical strength certainly has a lot to do with how good a hitter you're going to be, because the quicker the ball comes off of the bat, the quicker it's going to go by a shortstop or in between outfielders. So that is one of the big considerations. Now, the next thing is intelligence. The hitter that can sit on that bench and study the pitchers in the American League, have a good idea what pitch that pitcher's going to throw him if he gets up there in a situation, with a man on second base. So I can't say that's intelligence as far as the world is concerned, but it is common sense and baseball instinct. And some people just have a knack of knowing what pitch that the pitcher's going to throw them before they do. There's hitters that never look for anything but a fastball in the major leagues, and you know the type of pitchers that they can hit. There's other hitters that will, first time up, hit a curveball out of the ballpark, and they say to themselves, well, this guy can't come back with a curveball now after I've hit it out, and he'll look for the fastball and get his fastball and go to left field. There's hitters that cheat. They look back at the catcher, try to catch the signs, or whether the catcher's sitting on the inside part of the plate or the outside part of the plate, and sometimes get a glimpse back there, which is all in their favor. So there's so many things involved. But in the 10 years that I've been in the big leagues, we've had people come up. We've had people work as hard as you can possibly work and still fail. One of them, in our case, was a fellow at Rochester, hit 40 home runs, Jim Fuller, who we gave two or three chances to, but just couldn't figure out what the pitcher was going to throw him and swung at everything, but certainly had the physical power to hit the... In fact, here in Chicago, he hit one on the roof in batting practice. But we failed with him, and other guys that have come up that have worked hard and picked up just like Mark. You know, he's picked up that extra 20 points because he's an intelligent hitter and because he works at it, because he'll go to right field one week and left field another week. He's made himself an asset on our ball club because, number one, we certainly wouldn't want to do without his defensive ability. He stands alone at this time of the year with his glove and his defensive ability. So we just continue over a 10 or 11 year period to have him out at the ballpark more than somebody else when he's slumping and have him work. And on a number of occasions, 3 or 4 years out of the 10, he definitely contributed a lot with his bat also.
Well, he's really great. Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is an old friend and one of the Major League's great managers, Earl Weaver of Baltimore. And we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Remember, the White Sox conclude their series with Baltimore this afternoon, and it should be an exciting, a great ball game, and try to get out and see it. And we're delighted to have this morning our guest, Earl Weaver, the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. Earl, you've seen them come and go, and you've seen a lot of great pitchers and a lot of great hitters. The business of the left-hand hitter against the left-hand pitcher and the right-hand hitter in there against southpaws, is that overrated?
Well, if you're a good hitter, it is. But I believe in the platoon system. I think Casey Stengel did years back when he platooned two good, real good ball players, Hank Bauer and Gene Woodling. In doing so, he improved his ball club. And also, his thoughts were that he extended the career of both Woodling and Bauer because they weren't out there every day with a tremendous wear and tear on them. I believe in it to a certain extent, except when you find ball players like an Al Bunbury, really. I platooned him when he first got to the big leagues. He showed me that he can stay in there against left-handers. He can get his base on balls off of left-handers. More or less, he's an everyday ball player for us now. However, I will take him out against certain pitchers in the league, pitchers that have just given him trouble, you know, right from the start. Brett will take from Kansas City. Really doesn't make much difference whether a left-hander is on the mound. Daryl Porter will say, who's now catching for Kansas City, seems to be one of the guys that can stay in there. And certainly it doesn't make a lot of difference to a Reggie Jackson. However, Reggie is more apt, and I think if you'd look up back through his career, he's hit a lot more home runs off of right-handers than he has off left-handers. I think a left-hander will say pitching against Reggie Jackson has more spots to throw the ball to than a right-handed pitcher does. Number one, it's a natural tendency for a left-handed hitter just to back up a little bit on that sidearm curveball and fall away from the plate. And if your pitcher can consistently get that ball on the outside half of the plate, that gives you a little bit extra. Whereas a right-hander does not have a pitch to put on the outside half of the plate because Reggie can go out there and get that ball with the best of them. Then anything from the center to plate in, he can pull, and Reggie's strong enough, center to plate out, he can go to left center on you, double, triple, or sometimes even over the home. But a left-hander does have that outside half of the plate to throw to Reggie, and I think things like that are what have caused platoon, you know, in certain situations.
We had a very interesting guest here last week, Frank Lane, who's had all kinds of experience in baseball and now a super scout for the California Angels. And you should really pay him as your press agent. He said that you were not only the best manager in baseball, but you're two or three innings ahead of every manager in the big league. What about managing? Would you call it an art? What is it? And do some managers overmanage?
Well, I caught myself overmanaging last year early in the season, and as a result, I made a couple mistakes that really were costly. You don't know if anybody else, players that I had inserted or decisions I made would have come out differently. But I found myself trying to make the game a little bit too complicated and getting two or three hitters ahead and in the ball game when should have been concentrating more on things at hand now. You have to think ahead in a ball game, and you can't run yourself out of pinch hitters, we'll say, in the sixth or seventh inning. You've got to have that big man coming off the bench like Arta did against us last night, at the right time. And believe me, Lemon had him coming off of there at the right time as the tying run. And those type of things you have to think ahead. But baseball is still a simple game, a game of common sense, where if you do the right thing at the right time, you're going to win a lot more games than you lose. And if you think about one thing, especially the player, one thing at a time. You got men on first and third, we'll say in the eighth inning, and a tying run's on third base, and a second baseman's out there. If he's thinking, I got to get the double play, I got to get the double play, and then you hit that real tricky ball to him, one that's going to short hop him with a little spin on it, if he's thinking double play when he goes after that, there's more chance that he's going to miss that ball. What his thoughts should be right there are, catch that ball first. Make sure it don't get by you. Catch it. Good throw to the shortstop, and if we get him all right, if we don't, I've done everything possible. And I think in haste and thinking double play rather than catching the ball, that's one of the simple things. Changing pitchers usually is a guessing game. You try to use as much percentage on it as you can. If your pitcher's out there in the eighth inning and he's thrown 145 pitches, chances are that he's not going to have as good a stuff as somebody that you brought in. Last night we had a situation where it seemed like our pitcher had struggled. He was down 2-0. We finally got the lead. I went and checked the number of pitches he had thrown, and he had only thrown 78 pitches in seven complete innings. So I knew that he had plenty of gas left if he had thrown 120, 30 pitches at that time, again, it's just common sense, I might have brought Stenhouse out of the bullpen to start the inning. But Dennis had closed the door on him for two. He had looked good, and I knew that he had plenty of strength left, so I let him go out. We eventually got in trouble when Bloomberg came off the bench and hit a home run, but still had time to get my reliever in. But I think just basic common sense things. I got one thing that I do that I think that helps me. I've kept a running record of what my hitters hit against every pitcher in the American League, and they're just simple statistics. I go out and I see, we'll say Belanger against Kravick. He might be 2-for-14. Really, the more at-bats you get in a situation, the more significant it becomes. But we'll say Belanger is 2-for-14 off of Kravick. Late in the game, I might pinch hit because, you know, that's about 160 average, whereas against the Nolan Ryan now. Mark Belanger is the best hitter I have on my club against Nolan Ryan. And so leading off the ninth inning, even though Mark might only be hitting 219 at the time, he's the best hitter that I have to go up off of Nolan Ryan to get on base.
While you're speaking of Nolan Ryan, do you instruct your hitters to wait on him? He's wild sometimes. He walks 12.
Well, yeah, again, you let that take care of yourself. You don't know if he's going to have that control at the start of the game or not. So you let that develop, and if you see he starts to get wild, walks the first guy on four pitches, you might put a take on, which means don't swing at the first pitch or don't swing at the 2-0 as the game progresses.
Earl Weaver, as you observe the game, and I know that you keep a pretty tight line on every other club in the major leagues, all of these tremendous salaries, and they seem awfully big, what has it done to the attitude of the average ball player?
I don't think it's changed at all. A five-year contract, along with the salary being big, but say a fella has the security now for 5 years, he can't have a pay cut or he can't get a raise, one would think that he might become a little complacent. But I found that when they get the big money or the long contract, just pride itself or whatever you want to call it, makes the players go out and try just a little bit harder. I haven't had one that is just laid back on his security, the security that he got through a contract. And really, I haven't seen many around the league. Now, you're always going to have that one exception or two exceptions somewhere along, but we did in the old days. We'll take Alex Johnson. When he wanted to play ball, he played. And when he didn't want to, you know, he was a detriment to the ball club. You just had those type of people around. And the contracts really haven't changed the attitude of the ball player as far as I'm concerned at all.
Our guest this morning, and we're delighted to have him, is one of baseball's outstanding managers, Earl Weaver, the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. And we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Back to our guest, Earl Weaver, the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. He's stayed right in there last year with the Yankees and the Red Sox and almost did it. This year, he's off to a little bit of a slow start, but this ball club is always dangerous. Try to get out and see the final game of the series today. Someone brought up an interesting question. You were talking about your ball club and saying, if you could pick one player out of either league, the American League or the National League, right now, today, to help your club, who would it be?
Well, there's so many, but I think I'd have to go for one of those catchers that drive in the 100 runs and hit 300, a bench, a Fisk, Thurman Munson, and Thurman Munson especially has done something. He's hit 300 and drove in 100 runs 3 years consecutively as a Yankee. And you can go back to all the great Yankees, and there's not many of them that did that. And it's such a hard position to find, to fill both defensively and have a good person who can give you some offense. But, and you've always found the teams that had the good catchers, the Bears, the Howards, the Benches. Those are the teams that went on and won the pennant, because it's tough to fill that position both defensively and offensively.
When you fellas play the New York Yankees, what do you try to do with Reggie Jackson?
Well, if you got a good hard-throwing right-hander, you can go up with the fastball and stay.
Like Palmer.
If Palmer can handle him pretty good when he's got the good location and the hard stuff, he can throw up and in, and a slow breaking ball. The slower, the better, the breaking ball to Reggie. And then left-handers just have to push him away from the plate once in a while and get on that outside half with the breaking ball. But there's no guarantee that Reggie's swinging. You know Reggie's going to swing. And if he gets that bat in a spot where one of those balls there, you hope there's nobody on base, because then it's only one run in place of three.
That last game of the World Series was something, wasn't it?
Well, he gets in that type of groove, and I can't say that all of those pitches were good pitches, but they tried to keep the ball down on Reggie in that situation, and that's when he becomes a better hitter, when you get it down.
Earl Weaver, thanks so much for being our guest today, and it's a real pleasure to see you again, and good luck to you and the Baltimore Orioles.
Thanks, Bob. We'll need it.
Real nice to see you. Remember that next week our guest is going to be Bob Kennedy, the general manager of the Cubs. He will be here, and we have many, many things to talk about. The Cubs are playing good ball. He's made some astute deals, and we'll have many, many things to talk about. Try to get out and see the ball game if you can today, and have a happy day. And now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next week at the same time.